Support for this episode of Judaism Unbound comes from the Ashman Family JCC in Palo Alto, California, whose vision is to be the architects of the Jewish future. The Ashman Family JCC is an incubator for new expressions of Jewish identity. It creates innovative Jewish learning, celebrations, and arts programs that inspire personal connections to people and ideas from across the Jewish world. Learn more at www.paloaltojcc.org. This is Judaism Unbound, episode 131, Protesting God. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson.
And I'm Lex Rofberg.
And as we turn our attention toward the high holiday season that is coming up, we wanted to remind you of a project that we have underway looking at the month that comes before the high holidays, which we've called a Challah month of Elul, where we've put together a series of resources and special podcast episodes, which you can check out at our website, www.judaismunbound.com. It's right now on the homepage, and you can check all that out, sign up, and get all kinds of other resources to start to think about what the high holidays might mean coming up. And whatever work we want to do, whatever our conceptions about what the high holidays really are all about, but this is a month to sort of get ready for those rather than seeing them as sort of coming upon us suddenly. So we urge you to check those out. And we are also launching a series of podcast episodes today looking at the subject of God, which has come up here and there, of course, in previous podcast episodes, but which we've never really taken on as a subject in its own right. So for the weeks ahead and in the high holiday season, we're going to be talking to a variety of people who are thinking a lot about the question of God. We're really excited to be launching this series, and we have a lot of wonderful guests coming up. Our first guest is Professor Dov Weiss. He is Associate Professor of Jewish Studies in the Department of Religion at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Dov Weiss has his PhD from the University of Chicago Divinity School and also has rabbinical ordination from the Orthodox Rabbinical School at Yeshiva University. Although, as we'll get into in our conversation, Dov no longer considers himself an Orthodox Jew. Dov Weiss's first book is called Pious Irreverence, Confronting God in Rabbinic Judaism, published by the University of Pennsylvania Press, and it was the winner of the 2017 National Jewish Book Award in the category of scholarship. We're really excited to have Dov Weiss here on Judaism Unbound to talk about the history of the relationship of Jews and God. Dov Weiss, welcome to Judaism Unbound. It's so great to have you.
It's a great, great honor and pleasure to be here with you guys.
Well, we're excited to start this series looking at God, or I guess we should sort of mirror our recent series on Israel, saying that what we're looking at here is the relationship of American Jews and God. And we thought that it would be great to start off by talking to somebody who has really been reflecting on the relationship of Jews and God in a kind of a more academic historical setting. And so I think that this is a very big question, but we'll take it in pieces down the road. But I'm hoping that we can start by your giving us a little bit of an overview of who or what God is in the minds of Jews and of rabbis and of other Jewish leaders throughout the more ancient periods of our history.
Well, I think the definition of God throughout Jewish history has evolved quite radically. So when someone asks me, do you believe in God? My answer is always, are we referring to the biblical, rabbinic, philosophical, mystical, or Hasidic God? Because it means a lot of different things in a lot of different times throughout Jewish history. So in the biblical and the rabbinic period, so I'm talking now between the years 1000 BC all the way up to the year 700 CE, God was typically thought of as a character, as a human-like person with supernatural powers, supernatural knowledge, but essentially a human-like character. Once you get into the medieval period, that begins to break down. There begins to be a depersonalization of God. God really loses a sense of personality. And then when we move into the modern period, we move into the Hasidism. Some of the Hasidic strands think about God as the universe. And what we mean by monotheism has evolved. What is idolatry? obviously, whatever your conception of God is dictates what rejection of God means and what idolatry means. So my argument is always there is no essential meaning to God. And what binds Jews together throughout all of the generations has been this commitment to God. But what that means has changed.
Well, thinking about your book, Pious Irreverence, I'm thinking about how, at least let's start talking about the biblical and rabbinic periods. On the one hand, and I think that you really bring this out in your book, there's this tradition of the relationship, the Jewish relationship to God, not being what you might expect, that it's, you know, here's this all-powerful, king-like person that we should all kind of bow down to and do whatever he tells us. But there's this, there's actually that, and there's also the relationship of protest, of irreverence. And I'm wondering if you could guide us through a little bit how that relationship changes over time, or and what it looks like in the different eras.
Sure. Well, I mean, when you look at the Hebrew Bible, and the Hebrew Bible is really not a book. It's a library of books written by authors over 1,000 years, probably from around the 1200 BCE up until the second century BCE, the last book, the book of Daniel. And there are a lot of different conceptions, obviously, even within the Hebrew Bible. But what I think what unites the various conceptions of God in the Bible is God is a character, is a personality who welcomes protest, right? We have the famous protest of Abraham when God was about to destroy the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah. Abraham challenges God, critiques God, and God seems totally okay with the critique. When we look at the story of Moses, when God is about to destroy the people of Israel because the Israelites worshiped a golden calf, Moses turns to God and says, "What are you doing? You know, you are breaking the covenant. You are going to be making yourself the laughingstock of the nations." And God seems to accept the right of Moses to critique God. Of course, Job and the prophet Jeremiah, the prophet Habakkuk, again and again in the Hebrew Bible, we have biblical characters, biblical heroes who challenge God, criticize God. And that seems to be a legitimate method of communication towards God. And that fits very well with the conception of God in the Bible as a character who speaks, who gets angry. So there really is a human-like deity with very strong emotions and also insecurities as well. And I think that conception of God, God as a human-like character in that sense, I think lends very well to this openness towards critique, to protest.
Following up on that a little bit, when I was looking through your book, which is just really fantastic, we mentioned it in the intro, Pious Irreverence, but just one of the things that stuck out to me is that you really drop a bombshell with your argument around God, and specifically the rabbi's orientation to God around the concept of perfection. Like you say in your book, and it's really, I think, a compelling claim, that there were rabbis who didn't think God was perfect. And to those of us who have assumed that the story of that relationship with God was something along the lines of, in the Bible, there's this character, and then it starts to get a little murkier, but like all along that line, God is sort of infallible and impeccable and doesn't have flaws. To hear that there were rabbis who sort of are understood in many people's minds and in many ways are some founding thinkers of contemporary forms of Judaism, to hear that they might have thought that God wasn't perfect, it sort of blows your mind open, at least mine. So I'd love to hear more. What were they saying about God, and how does it relate to this general evolution of the perfection of God over time?
So I think that this notion of a God who is all perfect, all powerful, all good is a medieval invention within the Jewish context, beginning with Sa'adja Gaon in the 10th century, who's living in Baghdad, and reaching its high point with Moses Maimonides, the great Aristotelian Jewish philosopher. They promoted this notion that God must be perfect. influenced by Greek philosophy and also Arabic philosophy. They promoted the notion that God really can't be anything like a human being, because a human being is changing. A human being has body. I mean, one of the interesting things is that in the entire biblical and rabbinic tradition, there is no sense that God has no body. Of course God has a body. God is seen throughout the Bible and rabbinic literature. So there really is a revolution in the medieval period with Sa'adja Gaon and Maimonides. Maimonides turns these ideas not just into a belief, but into a dogma. And that's what he was really known for. And I think we really have to rethink, you know, we have to start to recognize within the Jewish tradition that before Sa'adja and before Maimonides, God was a fallible, imperfect being, character. And therefore, of course, critiquing God would be something that is at in play. We have dozens of instances in which the rabbis place a critique of God into the mouth of a biblical character, where God recognizes that he made a terrible mistake. I mean, the most radical example, I think, in the book is God recognizes that he made a mistake within one phrase of the Ten Commandments. In the Ten Commandments, it says, God says, you know, don't bow down to idols, because if you do, God will punish the children for the sins of the parents. And I think the rabbis really struggled with that. And in some of their texts, they placed into Moses a response. Moses turns to God, according to the rabbis, and says, God, this is unjust. What do the kids do? You're going to punish children for the sins of the parents? And in a really just quite earth-shattering midrashic response, the midrash is, of course, the ancient writings of the rabbis. God turns to Moses and says, you're right. I'm wrong. Lima detani, you've taught me something. I will nullify my word. I will nullify this phrase in the Ten Commandments, umekayem devarecha, and I will establish my theology according to your teachings. And I noted in the book a number of instances in which the rabbis paint a picture of God who concedes that he made moral mistakes. So you have in the Bible God, you know, making regrets, changing his mind at times. But within the rabbinic tradition, it reaches, I think, the highest levels, where God recognizes not only a one instance moment where God thinks, well, maybe I should have done it differently, right? Like in chapter 6 of Genesis, where God says that maybe I shouldn't have created the world the way I did. I'm going to bring a flood and restart again. In the rabbinic tradition, you have more of a change of policy, of kind of governing judicial policy of God's providence. And I think that's important for American Jews to recognize that sometimes God gets it wrong according to the oldest traditions of Judaism.
Well, I think that there's sort of two topics, right, that are going on here, at least two, right? But one is that, yes, there is this tradition, even in the most ancient sources of the Jewish tradition, of protest or challenge against God. And I think that there's also the reality that that it's kind of an up and down process, right? Like sometimes there are eras in which protesting God is seen as something that's fine to do, and there are other eras where it's less fine. And one of the things that I was intrigued about, I mean, you were just talking about Maimonides and Sa'adja Gaon, who come sort of after the period that we call the period of rabbinic literature, which sort of goes up through the Islamic period, the beginning of the Islamic period, and Sa'adja Gaon and Maimonides come after that. But what I was intrigued in your book was that there was also this period in the early rabbinic period of the famous Rabbi Akiva and his contemporaries, who seem to also be against the idea of challenging God, which I found kind of intriguing, because I would often think it's kind of the more, quote, progressive voices that might be the ones who would support challenging God. But here we see Rabbi Akiva, who's one of the progressive voices, and yet he's the leader of the idea that one shouldn't protest against God.
Within the early rabbinic tradition, so I would say the early rabbinic tradition is from right after the destruction of the second temple until the third century. Within the early rabbinic tradition, there seems to be a near unanimous attitude that criticizing God is inappropriate. And as you just said, that is a position that is adopted by the leading rabbinic figure of the second century, Rabbi Akiva. And I tried to show in the book that this is a point of view within the Jewish tradition that does have a voice, and that liberal Jews, progressive Jews, like, and I include myself as a progressive Jew, need to recognize that there is an anti-protest point of view, and that seemed to be the real dominant view within the Tannaitic sources. And I think, specifically with regard to Rabbi Akiva, I think it might be connected to his conception of God. Rabbi Akiva promoted a very radical view of God, that God suffers with the Jewish people. When the Jewish people are in exile, when the Jewish people are suffering, God as well suffers, is in exile. God cries. Rabbi Akiva and his students developed this tradition where they imagine God also being bound in chains after the destruction of the Second Temple. And I think that this connects with the question of protest, because I think once you conceive of a God who suffers with the people, right? So once you shift your image of God from God who punishes Israel to now God who is a victim along with Israel, I think it becomes more difficult to then celebrate and promote this idea of critiquing God for divine injustice when you have this image of a suffering God. And I think that may also have something to do with why Judaism developed the protest tradition and not Christianity. I mean, Christianity has this real strong sense of a God who suffers for them. But what's interesting is that when the rabbis do criticize God, even in the strongest of terms, they never do it on their own authority. They're always shifting the responsibility for the critique onto biblical characters, right? So the rabbis will say, well, we're not chutzpah. We're not, chutzpah dik to God. We're not irreverent to God. It's the great biblical heroes that are doing so. And I like to call that move protest ventriloquism, when you have others doing your dirty work. And I documented in the book about 150 of these protest moments that the rabbis are producing. And in many of these cases, God concedes that God made a mistake. Not all of them, maybe even a minority of them. But I think those become the most interesting. I think that 2 points. One is Jews are possibly being swayed by certain Christian groups, because we have to remember that during this period, there was an internal battle within Christianity as to whether the Old Testament God, what Jews refer to as the Hebrew Bible, whether the Old Testament God was the true God or not. And there was a group of Christians led by a man named Marcion, who believed that the Old Testament God was an evil, vengeful, hateful deity, and that the God of the New Testament is the true God. And I'd like to add one last thing, which I think is very interesting, is that in some of these anti-protest traditions, right, where the rabbis say in the early period following Rabbi Akiva that one is not allowed to challenge God or question God, what I really enjoy is when they start listing, you are not allowed to say that God made a mistake in the following 15 places. And I wonder, is this kind of like a way for the rabbis to critique God by saying, don't critique God in the following 15 places? Maybe the rabbi himself, who is presenting this teaching of one is not allowed to protest, maybe a way to protest God is by using this clever device of, you are not allowed to say that God made a mistake in this case, in this case, in this case, which really defeats the whole purpose of the teaching.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's a don't think of an elephant move. I mean, we've talked about that before, and it does precisely what it's saying it doesn't want to do. Of it's interesting,
right? But, whether it's purposeful or not is, I think, an open question.
Yeah, and so one thing I'm really interested is, so in hearing you talking about the intra-Christian debate, there it's so clear how largely the idea of God as perfect looms to both sides, because both of they're arguing about whether the God of what they would call the Old Testament is the real God or not. And what they're trying to prove is that that God is either good, moral, or not. And the implicit equivalence they're drawing is that if God is not moral in the Old Testament, then it's not really God, because God has to be moral. And that basic presumption is present in both sides. And they're not really duking it out over that. They're duking it out over the question of whether God is God in the Old Testament, or if that's like not the real one. So I wanted to name that because it does sort of help hammer home your point about the difference in those contexts, the intra-Christian debate and the intra-Jewish debate. But the other piece I really want to follow up on is this ventriloquism piece, because I think it is such a big deal, both the insight you made for the Talmud itself and sort of in understanding what it's even doing, like what's happening in those texts. But I also want to name that what's so incredible about it is like people do it now, but with the rabbis. So I'll explain, like the rabbis at their time were like, well, we're kind of lowly and don't have that much respect. So if we make a criticism, then it's not going to be seen as legitimate. So we need to put it on Moses and say that he's voicing the criticism so that people will really start to listen to it. Now people, when they have a criticism of God or whatever, they say like, well, Rabbi Akiva said it. And so it's this like fascinating thing where the consistency over time is that Jews are critiquing stuff, but saying it was their earlier forebears. But the real question now, talk to us more about ventriloquism. What are they doing here? And why is it such a core point to understand as we wrestle with Jewish history?
What the rabbis often do is they find protection by shifting the responsibility for their teaching or for their, in our case, the criticism of God, by claiming that it's not their doing, that it's not the rabbis who are critiquing God, but it is various biblical heroes, biblical characters that are criticizing God. And so what that does is it effectively protects them from any charges of irreverence, but at the other hand, it allows them to express their deepest moral concerns and reservations with regard to improper divine conduct. We can place our outrage and frustration over how can God do this. We can express that voice. Obviously, we're not going to do that explicitly because that's maybe too much in the rabbinic community, but we'll have these biblical characters carry these strong protests against God. The rabbis can say, well, it wasn't me who said that God is acting like a petty, jealous lover. It's Abraham, you know, it's Moses. Not only do the rabbis often place critiques of God into the mouth of biblical characters, but they even search within the Bible itself for the language of Bible itself. They want to argue that this protest and the details of the protest can be found within the words and letters of the Bible itself. So I'll give you one great example of protest ventriloquism. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 33 that Moses was a man of God. And the rabbis say, well, no, don't read it. Don't read that Moses was a man of God, but that Moses was God's husband. The word ish can mean in the Hebrew Bible, either man or husband. The rabbis say, don't read it as man, but read it as husband, that Moses was God's husband. And in a patriarchal society, you know, whatever the man says, whatever the husband says, the wife concedes. So the rabbis say that Moses was like God's husband, and that whatever Moses demanded of God and whatever Moses critiqued God about, God would accede. And the rabbis then say, well, if scripture hadn't said that, E.F. Sharla Omro, of course, we would never, ever be able to make such a claim, because that's so radically audacious, that is so irreverent. Of course, to say such a thing is ridiculous, but we're not saying it. It's because scripture said it. Now, of course, scripture doesn't say it. Scripture only says it when you make scripture say it.
I'm thinking about this as it's kind of a reverse plagiarism. It's like the inverse of plagiarism. So like, I mean, I'm talking to you, you're an academic. I'm assuming you've got students and like what the rabbis are doing is like, it's like if I were to write a paper and sign it, I don't know, Jonathan Sarna, or like I'm just like thinking big wig Jewish studies professor. Like
I have this image of like Abraham or Moses, you know, in heaven saying, "No, I did not say that. What are you doing?"
Yeah, right. No, that's totally right.
Yeah, that's the reverse plagiarism. That's a great way to characterize it.
Thank you. But so I wanted to ask like a little bit of a gear shift question, but I do think it's very relevant. You've been using, and I'm not saying this as how dare you, like you've been using he pronouns for God. And I think it'd be good to back out for a second because A, I know that some of our upcoming guests in this unit of episodes on God intentionally don't use he pronouns or any personal pronouns to describe God. They'll just use the word God or they'll use other Hebrew names for God, whatever. But I'd love to hear sort of what you are communicating when you use he pronouns for God, because I have a suspicion that there's like some interesting pieces there. And also more broadly, not just a you question, using he pronouns is sort of making a personalized move. It's making a personal God kind of move because you're using a personal pronoun. And so I wanted to hear a little more from you because you talk so much about the act and the idea of anthropomorphizing or like seeing God in an anthropomorphized form, like a person. So basically, I'd love to hear more why you, when you're talking about God, use the word he and his and him, and also sort of this broader question about personal.
Those are related. That's a great question. I think that in the Bible and in rabbinic literature, God is conceived of as a human-like personality, a person, someone who speaks and gets angry and loves. And therefore, I describe God as not an it, but as a he. And the reason why I choose he and not she is because the dominant picture of God in the Hebrew Bible is a God who is the husband, the metaphoric husband of Israel. And therefore, since the dominant metaphor that is used to describe God in the Bible and rabbinic literature is as a husband of Israel or the Jewish people, that's why I tend to use the pronoun of he. There are exceptions, and I just mentioned one of the exceptions, that Midrash where the Midrash claims that Moses was the husband of God. So there, God is in the feminine. What I think you have in medieval Judaism is a complete destruction of God as he in both the philosophical and mystical traditions. In the philosophical tradition, God becomes an it. God is a concept, not a character. So God is perfect, unchanging, eternal. God has real no relationship with humanity. God cannot be anything like a human being. I mean, for Maimonides, that is the greatest heresy, is to call God a he. To claim that there's any correspondence between God and humanity is heresy. So therefore, God has to be an it. And in the Kabbalistic tradition, God is a they. There's the Tiferet, which is masculine, and Shekhinah, which is feminine. And therefore, God is really a family of he's and she's. So in my writings, when I describe the biblical and rabbinic tradition, I use he, but you are right. I mean, I really should nuance that and, you know, explain why I'm using the he, because it is the dominant metaphor that is used, both in the Bible and rabbinic tradition. But that anthropomorphized conception of God does break down in medieval Judaism with these two new movements of Jewish philosophy and Jewish mysticism. And I think it returns. I think the humanity of God does return, I think, in Hasidic literature, where God becomes a character again. And therefore, it's no coincidence that in the medieval period, we don't really have much protest literature against God, but it returns in Hasidism.
Yeah, I mean, that sort of connects to a question that I've been mulling over. And I think it's sort of, there's two elements to it. One is sort of the question of who God is over time. And then the question is, based on your sense of who God is, does that make a positive orientation towards protest more or less likely? And, you know, I was sort of wondering, as, you know, as God becomes conceived of as less and less of a character, does that make protest sort of more or less permissible? You know, it sounds like from what you've been saying, it sounds like sort of less in the sense that what's the point if God isn't really a character, then why are we having this conversation?
Yeah, it's like you're having an argument with an it. I mean, there's no dialogue. I mean, God doesn't really hear you. It's futile. It's futile.
But then maybe then my question then goes sort of beyond your, you know, your book's topic of protest and more to this question of the nature of God and how that's conceptualized throughout Jewish history. And again, also today, I don't know, like the way that I'm thinking about it is that if the Bible clearly has God as a character, you know, as a human-like character with a body, with, you know, that you can talk to. And then Maimonides, to take an extreme case, says, you know, basically, if you try to say anything about God, it's terrible and you're wrong and, you know, you can't be done. You know, isn't there a way in which looking at these different conceptions of God as sort of saying, yeah, so in relation to the conception of God that we had in this past time, you, sir, are an atheist, right? You know, I'm trying to sort of understand, you know, how do we kind of think about it and how did they think about that we have these radically different understandings of who God is at different points in time, and yet we sort of aren't willing to accept the idea that we've actually rejected that previous God in some significant way that the people who were alive at that time would have said, I hear that you're trying to say that you believe in God, Maimonides, but the fact is that what you're saying is functionally saying that you don't believe in God as I understand
it. Right. I mean, the rabbis would probably look at Maimonides and say, you know, you're an atheist. And Maimonides would look at the rabbis and say, you're all idolaters and heretics because, you know, you think God has body and God changes and all of this. So, you know, it is. It's really a fascinating thing. When I think about the different conceptions of God, I often like to think of the question of monotheism. I mean, what does it mean, one God? You have drastically different views about what that means. And that is such a core concept, a core notion of the Shema prayer of Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord one. So what does one mean? So in the biblical and rabbinic tradition, it means there's one God you worship, not many gods. But for Maimonides would reject that. Maimonides would say that that's not sufficient. You have to believe not only that there is one God and not many gods, but that God is radical oneness, that there's no duality within God. And then it reaches its crescendo in the writings of Lubavitch Hasidut, where this new conception of the one God is that the whole world is God, that everything material in this world, this desk that I'm sitting at, is infused, it penetrates with divine power. And if you deny that, if you think that the world is separate from God, that's idolatry, because the oneness of God means the oneness of the world. Those people who argue that there is something called Judaism, there's an essential Judaism, I turn to them and say, the core prayer that God is one means not just different things for different Jews, but often it's mutually exclusive interpretations of what that means. So, you know, the Kabbalists would turn to the Jewish philosophers and they would say, well, you guys are you're getting the Shema all wrong. And the philosophers would turn to the Kabbalists and would say, you guys are getting the whole Shema prayer, because they have radically different conceptions of God. And for me, I find that wonderful, because that allows me in my own life to really think about what God means to me in my own personal way. It's not a static definition.
Dov, I thought this could be a good opportunity to explore a little bit of your own personal history with all this, because like me, you come from a background that was Orthodox. You stuck with it a lot longer than I did and ultimately became an Orthodox rabbi. And when we first met about 12 years ago, when you were starting to study at the University of Chicago, I guess the year before, you'd been more in the world of being an Orthodox rabbi. I'm curious how that transition happened personally and how you kind of reflect on the things that you're talking about now and studying now, you know, and how do they connect or not connect with the contemporary world? And you know, how is... I guess I think that, you know, I have an impulse. I'm trying to sort of explore this, that somehow the Orthodox world today in America and Israel is sort of in one of these periods where it's not very protesty and it's not very interested or willing to look for the interpretive ways to sort of reshape the past in order to foster a different present and future. There's some sort of reluctance or fear of doing that. And I'm curious on your reflection on that, and also to what extent did that sort of animate your leaving that community?
I think I've always struggled with the morality of God in the Torah. And I think that's really where how I came to this topic is I often express my moral frustrations and questions, and I spent many years at Yeshiva University, which is the mainstream Orthodox institution in America, and I was ordained at Yeshiva University, and I never felt when I was there that I could fully express my moral struggles and concerns. And one of the things that really excited me when I started the study of Midrash in an academic setting is I never realized that the rabbis themselves, I think, really struggled with a lot of these same questions, and it gave me a sense of comfort. I left Orthodoxy because I found myself in an educational world where there was an obsession with one book of our tradition, the Talmud, and there was an obsession with one method of studying that Talmud, and I just felt kind of myopic in terms of my understanding of Judaism. So, I mean, ultimately, I left that world and I left the tradition because I came to the conclusion that it just can't be that the Torah is the word of God. The God that I want to worship and submit to is not a God who is going to command the Israelites to kill men, women, and children of the seven indigenous, native populations of Canaan. I remember I was once asked to give a lecture at an Orthodox synagogue on war and the ethics of war from a traditional Jewish perspective. And I was up all night crying. It couldn't be. I said to myself, it couldn't be. This cannot be the word of God. I thought about just completely leaving Jewish tradition altogether, but I had too much of a love for the text of the tradition. I had too much of a love for Torah. But I became to love the study of Judaism and ancient Jewish texts. I started to love it more once I recognized that it was a human hand. In other words, mm-hmm. when I believed that the Torah was the work of God, I thought to myself, God could have done a lot better, right? the all perfect, the moral, the great God, come on. Killing innocent people is not the God that I want to worship. And then when I came to recognize the Bible as a human construction over many years by many different authors, I thought to myself, wow, this is a really quite an extraordinary text and critical text for the Western tradition. And academia really kind of gave me a way out because I knew I didn't want to continue in a rabbinic capacity because I didn't want my life to be about defending religious texts that I found abhorrent. But I still love the tradition. I love the history. I love the culture. And I think there is beauty within the tradition. There are beautiful statements. There are beautiful statements in the Bible. God does amazing things in the Bible. It's a mixed bag. And I want to be able to say, yeah, I'll take this, but I'm not going to take that. So for me, Judaism has become more about heritage and tradition. But it was the moral, for me, it wasn't biblical criticism that drove me from Orthodoxy. It was the immorality of the biblical God. I mean, sociologically, I'm quite still culturally Orthodox, probably halakhically conservative and theologically Reconstructionist. So I decided, you know what? I'll go into academia, just be who I want to be and love the tradition and teach the tradition and write books like Pious Irreverence that hopefully can be a good resource for rabbis and for traditional Jews that are struggling with the morality of God. I remember when I was still single, back in the day, and J-Date would ask me for like, how to identify. And I was like, well, it's complicated. sociologically, psychologically, halakhically,
It wasn't an essay question. It was,
you gotta check off the box, I just did traditional because I am a traditional Jew.
Right.
And the traditional Jew is sometimes against the tradition.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've mentioned this on the podcast in the past, but I'm gonna do it again now. Shameless plug for this. I have this dream that I'll make a new kind of like heretical Talmud or something. And it will start with, so the tractate Pirkei Avot, which is a famous section of the Talmud that talks about, that quotes a bunch of rabbis, and it starts by saying sort of the chain of tradition. So Moses received this at Mount Sinai, and then Joshua, and then passed it, and then sort of you get into the rabbis who are going through their different ethical ideas. I have this vision that we'll make one that's like, and Korach got the heretical Torah and passed it to Elisha ben Abuya, who's like the Talmud's most famous heretic, who passed it to Emma Goldman, who said, I don't want it, I'm going to do my own, who passed it backwards to Baruch Spinoza, who passed it like really yeah. wonky, out of way, like something like that, that just like creates like this anchor idea, at least, of Jewish heresy by pinning it on real genuine heretics of the past that I think are actually our teachers alongside those other folks that are like theoretically the heroes. Anyway, so that was a little bit of a digression, but the question I wanted to ask was about protest in general, forgetting God for a second. Like, this book is about protesting God, but I think there's a lot of clear ways that people, if they wanted to, I mean, I don't know if this was in your intent or not, but like if they wanted to read this as a book about protest in one particular culture and towards one particular being or non-being, and then like think about protest more broadly. I mean, we live in a society where questions of protest and the legitimacy of protest and when to protest and how to protest and all of this are sort of on the table. And what's so funny is that, at least in the Jewish circles that I travel in, like protesting God, like everybody's cool with that. Like that's no biggie. I mean, we just had our Israel unit. People get much more up in arms about protesting Israel than they do about protesting God. So, but I guess I'm curious, do you think that there's, for lack of a better term, Torah here for those looking to learn just about protest in a world that many of us think is in need of such public protest?
No, I think there definitely is, because one of the things I try to do in the book is really to theorize what does it mean to critique another person or to critique an idea, whether we use the term critique or protest, which has a certain little bit of a different valence as a movement, as a political protest. But I think criticism and challenge and protest, they can serve different purposes and functions. And one is to simply ask a question. You know, I can challenge somebody because I don't fully understand what somebody else is doing. On the other extreme, we can protest or critique because the goal is to change someone's opinion, right? So I can critique a friend of mine or challenge or protest because I want them to change their direction. If a critique is for the purpose of changing someone's point of view, critiques can be done from the perspective of love. In the book, I also try to break this down a little bit. We do have some rabbinic statements that seem to distinguish between these various types of critiques. A critique against God that is aimed at basically saying, you know, F you to God and I hate you, God, right? Which is something the rabbis will say, no, that's not an appropriate method of communication with the divine. But then there are types of protest and critique that are launched for the purpose of change. You know, there's a very, it's a beautiful phrase in the Midrash. It says, I'll say it in Hebrew and then translate it. It says, "Kol ahava she'enimo tochacha eno ahava." Any love, any true love that is not accompanied with rebuke or critique is not true love. And you can understand that in a lot of different ways. But one of the ways to explain it is that if you really love something, if you're in a loving relationship, you have to be fully present in that relationship. You have to be honest. You have to be true. You have to feel like the relationship is strong enough that it can withstand, that it could hold an honest critique. Because otherwise, you're just a robot. If you're not allowed to criticize the other, then you're a slave. And this connection between love and critique, or love and protest, is not something that is only in the Jewish tradition. It was a motif very strong in the Greco-Roman world. These two Greek concepts, one is philia, which is love, and paresia, which is open speech, open rebuke, frankness of speech. In the ancient world, it was said that emperors often sought out assistants who are not sycophants, but people who would be critical and challenge, because ultimately that should be a positive thing. I send out my articles, you know, and I want critique. I want feedback. I want criticism, because criticism is good. Criticism will help me get to a deeper place. So critique, obviously, can be destructive. It could be painful, certainly if done in a certain way. So you got to be smart with how you challenge and critique and protest. But it could also, if done in the correct way, for the right purpose, I think it could actually not only transform the listener of the critique or the listener of the rebuke, but it could also transform the relationship between the challenger and the one who is being challenged.
Thank you so much, Dov Weiss, for joining us. This has been a great conversation.
Thank you. It's been a great honor and a great pleasure. I listen to your podcast, and I think it's fantastic. And I just want to wish you much, much bracha, much blessing and success for many, many more years. It was really an honor and privilege.
Thanks again to Dov Weiss for joining us for this conversation and kicking off our unit on God. We're going to have a bunch more episodes where we explore this pretty big topic in Jewish tradition and contemporary practice. So we hope you will continue along with us. We want to close out this episode, as we always do, by encouraging all of you to be in touch with us. And there are a few ways for you to do that. First, you can head to our Facebook page, Judaism Unbound. Second, you can go to Twitter and find us at Judaism Unbound. Third, you can go to our website, judaismunbound.com. And last but not least, you can hit us up via email at dan@judaismunbound.com or lex@judaismunbound.com. We also want to give a big, massive shout out to all of you who are journeying along with us through Elul Unbound, this month-long initiative we have leading up to the high holidays. We thought that there'd be people interested and that it'd be fun, but we had no idea that as we record this, 500 folks would sign up to participate. It's really been incredible for us to see the interest that there is in this on-ramp month to the high holidays, you know, for introspection and curiosity and inward looking and forward looking and all the stuff that we are doing. So thanks to all of you who have started to participate already. And for those of you who haven't, head to JudaismUnbound.com, click the daily email link right from the homepage to join our Elul Unbound email list and explore all of our online resources from there. We have worked really hard to create something that we think can help deepen your experience of this month, so please check it out. The last plug we like to make is that, of course, you can always support us financially. You can do so at JudaismUnbound.com/donate with either a monthly recurring gift or a one-time donation. So anything you can do on that front would be greatly appreciated. We hope you enjoyed this episode. And with that, this has been Judaism Unbound.